Okay. Nobody seems to worry about nuclear war since the Cold War ended, but it remains probably the greatest threat to civilization right now. It's mostly out of the public's thoughts these days, but the United States and Russia still have thousands of nuclear weapons ready to fly, by order or by accident. My favorite end-time scenario by far is human extinction via a massive methane burp from the seafloor. Yes, believe it or not, the gaseous residue of hundreds of millions of years of microbial activity beneath the bottom of the ocean might be unleashed in one colossal fart that kills us all by abruptly altering the atmosphere and climate we depend on. Critics less forgiving than me might feel it would be poetic justice, a fitting end for the species responsible for two world wars and too many boy bands. Don't panic and run screaming into the streets just yet, however. Even these frightening evidence-based scenarios probably wouldn't cause our extinction because we may develop the means to predict, avoid, eliminate, or lessen their impact. This is why it is vital for us to continue exploring and discovering. Some of the answers we find today may save us tomorrow. There is also strength in numbers. Remember, there are more than 7 billion of us now, and we are spread across much of the planet. Our large population, combined with our creative intelligence, makes us a very tough species to kill off. A 2009 University of Colorado study supports my view on this, concluding that we are unlikely to become extinct without a combination of difficult, severe, and catastrophic events. The researchers said that it was hard to come up with plausible scenarios capable of killing everybody, but this doesn't mean that the world isn't doomed. In fact, it almost surely is. In 4 or 5 billion years, our star will die like all stars eventually do, but the sun won't go quietly. It will behave like an angry man, dying, punching, and flailing at anyone near. After all the life-giving support it provided for billions of years, the sun's final act will include frying the earth and boiling away all its water. But there is still plenty of room for hope. 4 billion years is a long time. It is unlikely, if not impossible, that we would be close to anything resembling what we think of as a human today, if we still exist. Maybe by then our descendants will be living comfortably on a safer planet far away or on an artificial world they built. Maybe they will have become so technologically advanced that they can control the sun or somehow protect the earth from its fury. But even if we can dodge the sun's wrath, we might not be able to escape ultimate doomsday. Current thinking among astronomers says our expanding universe is likely to go dark in about 100 trillion years or so. Still, we might escape by jumping to another universe or circling back in time. Then again, maybe humanity, along with all our accomplishments, creations, and memories, will be erased from the cosmos forever. Time will tell. Evidence-based predictions of possible doomsday scenarios, while fascinating and well worth concern where appropriate, just are not a big problem for very many people. If one thinks critically and carefully about such ideas, and assesses the danger like a good scientist might, then there's not much to lose sleep over. Yes, we need to improve our early detection abilities for near-Earth objects that may threaten us. We also need to be ready to respond effectively when they do. Yes, we should do more to discourage and prevent people and nations from weaponizing viruses and bacteria. We also might want to reduce nuclear arsenals to only enough firepower needed to destroy civilization, say once or twice and no more. The key to dealing with this subject sensibly is, of course, science and skepticism. When irrational thinking creeps in, apocalyptic thoughts not only become silly, but also can turn dangerous. There are many examples of irrational believers doing terrible things in the name of doomsday. To my knowledge, however, there are no suicidal groups based solely on a scientific reading of the sun's expiration date. There are no apocalyptic religions centered on what geologists say about supervolcanoes. I doubt anyone has quit his job and sold his house in anticipation of the big methane burp or the rise of artificial intelligence. No, the science of doomsday, while important, is not just a popular source of self-destructive behavior. It is belief in unscientific doomsday claims that consistently causes the trouble. Far back in time, during the first days of civilization or even earlier perhaps, some man or woman told anyone who would listen that the world was about to end in some spectacular way that would kill everybody, and people bought it. So began a weird and steady freak show of human behavior. For generation after generation, in society after society, hundreds of millions of people have believed in countless doomsday claims. They always come with excessive drama and are delivered with unwavering confidence. But good evidence and logical arguments are never part of the presentation, which probably explains why the failure rate of these predictions is 100% to date. Why does this diseased thinking keep infecting us? I'm not sure, but I do know that skepticism is the cure. It's impossible to know accurate numbers, but there is no doubt that throughout history many millions of people have suffered and or died as a direct result of belief in irrational, never-going-to-happen doomsday declarations. Does our fascination with death somehow derail our ability to recognize and reject stories that are clearly made up? Maybe all or most of us come with a built-in doomsday fetish that makes this weird seduction inevitable. Maybe our fondness for patterns leads us to imagine a near and specific end to the human story, just for the sake of completing the picture or closing the loop. The good news is that you never have to fall for these stories. All you need to do is think like a scientist, and the madness bounces right off. Skeptics are the last people on Earth who will burn up nervous energy, throwing away money, join a kooky organization, kill themselves, or harm anyone else in anticipation of a doomsday prediction that no one is able to back up with good evidence. We know that it makes sense to assume that there will be a tomorrow. Skeptical thinking has defied doomsday and saved the world many times before and can again. All we have to do is think, and those scary predictions wither and die. Moon landing hoax. How did this happen? How could humankind's greatest adventure and greatest technological achievement end up being called a hoax and a secret conspiracy by millions of people around the world? The Apollo program landed men and on the moon 6 times. The astronauts talked to us from the moon. They took photographs. They filmed their moonwalks. They brought back nearly 1,000 pounds of rocks. Nevertheless, many people deny that the moon landings ever happened. They charge that it was an elaborate trick designed to make the United States look good during the Cold War. President Richard Nixon and NASA lied to us. The astronauts were actors. As we covered in the section on conspiracy theories, great stories are irresistible to the human brain. We can't help ourselves. We have to listen to stories and gossip. We can't stop ourselves from considering them and imagining if the wild claims are true. The juicier, the better. The urge to believe in and spread gossip is probably instinctual, just part of who we are, say some researchers. It's less about what we do and more about who we are. Gossiping primates is not only a great name for a rock band, it's also who we all are deep down. In light of this, I think that something like the moon hoax claim should be viewed as less a kooky aberration and more an inevitability. The Apollo missions were too big, too complex, too difficult, and too spectacular for everyone to accept. When the moment arrives that a human finally walks on Mars, I guarantee that some subset of the world will say it's happening on a Hollywood soundstage. Because I'm committed to being an open-minded skeptic, I have always made the effort to listen to and consider the arguments of moon hoax proponents. No matter how ridiculous some of the ideas may seem to me, I don't automatically dismiss them without at least thinking them over. One never knows what will happen tomorrow, but this claim does not appear to be doing well in America today. Only about 6% of the adult population believe it was all a hoax, according to Gallup. Although that figure represents millions of Americans, it's definitely a fringe number for a poll. One can ask just about anything and get at least 6% to agree to it. However, we also have to consider how many people doubt the landings, if not deny them. There is also the question of how many non-Americans don't believe anyone has been to the moon. I have lived outside the United States and traveled extensively, and many times I have been shocked to discover how widespread this belief is. Based on my experiences, it's very common to many Asian, African, and Caribbean countries. One poll found that a quarter of all British people are moon hoax believers. Motivations for this belief vary, I'm sure. It might be ignorance about science, what's the moon, poor knowledge of history, President Nixon was impeached for his role in the moon hoax, right? Lack of imagination, there's just no way. Or even anti-American sentiments. I hate Americans, therefore they never went to the moon. Late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez was a moon hoax believer, probably in large part because he didn't like the United States. Some people, members of the Taliban in Afghanistan are a good example, are so lost in medieval thinking and superstition that they likely view it as impossible for mere mortals to achieve such a voyage. For some, it may be a result of the formal education they received. I had heard, for example, that the moon hoax claim is taught to children as fact in Cuban schools. I was very curious about this when I visited that country. But as an American citizen allowed in as a journalist, I wasn't in a position to stir up political debates, so I skirted around the issue. The Cuban people I encountered were consistently bright and had positive views about science, but some were unconvinced that NASA ever sent men to the moon. Young people today in all countries seem particularly vulnerable to this belief, perhaps in part because the landings happened in the 1960s and 1970s and therefore feel like ancient history to them, which makes it more difficult to believe. After all, they don't see anyone going to the moon today. So how did people do it with prehistoric 20th century technology? No cell phones or laptops, but they went to the moon? Sure, it doesn't help that any curious kid with a computer can watch or read moon hoax propaganda on the web. Without some honest context and sensible counterarguments, it can seem credible, I'm sure. In 2001, Fox TV broadcast a terrible pseudo-documentary during primetime called Conspiracy Theory, Did We Land on the Moon? It probably helped inspire a new wave of irrational deniers then, and it's still derailing brains online today. YouTube clips from it have drawn hundreds of thousands of views. Professional presentations work, regardless of how factually incorrect or dishonest they may be. One survey found that 27% of young Americans aged 18 to 24 had some doubt that astronauts went to the moon, and 10% said it was highly unlikely. When I read about such statistics or meet people who believe in the hoax, my first reactions are sympathy and disappointment. I feel sad for those who feel no connection to this important accomplishment. It was a human feat that all people should at the very least take some measure of pride in. Sure, it was motivated by Cold War militarism and shallow nationalism, but it was still profoundly special and meaningful. The moment the first humans landed on the moon, we were no longer an earthbound species. We had extended our physical reach, and in doing so expanded our collective ability to dream bigger dreams. Or at least that's what should have happened. The following are a few of the more common moon hoax ideas that I have heard, followed by brief responses. Remember, as with everything else in this chapter, I'm not encouraging you to agree with me because I'm right. Whether you are in your 60s or in the 6th grade, I want you to think for yourself and make up your own mind. So when I share personal insights and experiences, please don't think that I am suggesting that you follow my lead because I'm some kind of an authority figure. You need to make up your own mind about this and every other extraordinary claim. Where are the stars? This is probably the most common of all the challenges to the moon landings. It's also the easiest to explain. If those astronauts were really on the moon, hoax believers ask, then why are there no stars in the black space behind them? It looks suspiciously like the black wall of a movie studio soundstage. The reason for this is simple. Stars in space are relatively faint dots of light. The surface of the moon, however, is very bright when the sun is shining on it. So, too, are the lunar module landing vehicle and the white spacesuits the astronauts wore on the moon. Therefore, in order to take a decent photograph in such conditions, the camera's shutter speed must be set to a speed that is too fast to take in the relatively faint light from stars. The result is a photograph with properly lit astronauts, but only black space behind them. If you still have doubts, try it yourself. Go out on a starry night and take a photo of a well-lit building or person. If the shot comes out well for the primary subject, you won't see stars. It's about differences in light. The contrast was so great, in fact, that Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke says he couldn't even see stars with his eyes while on the surface of the moon. The flag waved. There is a film clip hoax, believers say, shows the American flag waving in the wind on the moon. Of course, this could not have happened because the moon has no atmosphere, no wind. But there it is, plain as day for anyone to see, flapping around. Clearly somebody opened a door in the studio or turned on a fan while the fake flag planting on the moon was being filmed. Don't confuse moving with flapping in the wind. Yes, the flag moves, but why? It moves because an astronaut wiggled the flagpole while driving it into the lunar surface. There may not be wind, but the laws of physics are still enforced up there just like they are down here on Earth. The flag moves because of inertia. Movement of the flagpole results in movement of the attached flag. Simple as that. Tricky Dick. Some people point to the man who was in the White House during the Apollo landings as a key reason to believe this conspiracy theory. But just because someone is known for lying and being involved in conspiracies doesn't mean everything he or she was ever involved with is necessarily corrupt. President Richard Nixon may have been an unethical politician, but this alone is not proof that he orchestrated 6 fake moon landings. Watergate does not prove Moongate. They lied. I have met many people who participated directly in America's space program during the Apollo years. I spoke with some casually at science conferences. Others, I conducted lengthy formal interviews with for various writing projects. The following is a partial list. Gene Cernan, Apollo 10, Apollo 17 commander. John Young, Apollo 10, Apollo 16 commander. Charlie Duke, Apollo 16. Gene Kranz, Mission Control Center flight director. Alan Bean, Apollo 12. Buzz Aldrin, Apollo 11. Scott Carpenter, Mercury 7 astronaut. Tom Stafford, Apollo 10 commander. Frank Borman, Apollo 8 commander. Rusty Schweikert, Apollo 9. Jim McDivitt, Apollo 9. Walter Jacoby, engineer, member of Wernher von Braun's rocket team. Dave Scott, Apollo 9, Apollo 15. Ted Sassine, Apollo spacecraft engineer. Jack Chern, lunar module engineer. James O'Kane, Apollo spacesuit engineer. I think it is important to bring this up because if the landings were a hoax, it means that all of these people, and many more, are liars. If no one ever went to the moon, then for all these years, they have kept the greatest secret in history. Perhaps it's possible that they could be lying, but it does not seem plausible to me, because I looked in the eyes of astronauts John Young, Gene Cernan, and others as they shared personal memories of their time on the moon with me. Prominent Apollo engineers told me about the hard work and long hours it took to create machines capable of carrying people to the moon and returning them safely to Earth. Mission Control Flight Director Gene Kranz described to me how he felt during those long missions. It is easy to accuse men of lying when they are nothing more than printed names or two-dimensional faces on television. But when you meet them and listen to their heartfelt stories firsthand, it is difficult to imagine how they could all be liars. For example, Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke told me that he left a photograph of his wife and children on the moon. Seems like overkill, that he's just protecting a hoax. It can't be for the money, because an Apollo astronaut could make millions by coming clean and exposing the conspiracy. Besides, why would they go so far above and beyond the call of duty to sell a scam after so many years have passed? The Cold War ended a long time ago. The Soviet Union doesn't even exist anymore. Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon are all dead. I suppose it is possible that they all lied to me as they have to the world. Perhaps all of them are great actors, and maybe every one of them found the will to keep this secret for more than 40 years. But I doubt it. Where's the crater? If you look at photographs of the lunar module, the Apollo landing vehicle on the moon, you will notice that there is not a deep crater beneath it. Why not? Ask hoax believers. Why didn't the lunar module, with its powerful rocket engine, blast a big crater in the lunar surface? The answer is simple. Those clever NASA engineers thought to install a throttle in the lunar module. What happens when sprinters cross the finish line in a 100-meter race in outdoor stadiums? They slow down, right? They decrease their effort and coast a bit before stopping short of running into a wall or a fence. They certainly don't continue running at full speed until a wall or fence stops them. Same with the lunar module. When Apollo 17 Commander Gene Cernan wanted to descend to the lunar surface, he throttled back for a gentle landing. He didn't make a crater because he didn't land with the engine at full output. He couldn't have, because an engine at full throttle would have made landing impossible. As with many such odd beliefs, a little knowledge can go a long way with the moon hoax claim. Unfortunately, most Americans know very little about the Apollo program and know even less about the efforts of the U.S. military and NASA that preceded it. They are also mostly unfamiliar with the Soviet Union's important and successful space program. The Soviets were very sophisticated and ahead of the United States during much of the 1960s. They almost certainly would have figured it out if the United States faked the landings, and we can be sure that they would have told the world about it. The late Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon, summed it up nicely. It would have been harder to fake it than to do it. Only 5% of Americans know how many astronauts walked on the moon. Most think it is only one, two, or three. The vast majority of people seem to think there was just one mission, Apollo 11, presumably. But the reality is that NASA made 9 voyages to the moon. 6 of those landed, and a total of 12 men walked on the surface. This raises the question of why the government would have gone to all the trouble of faking it so many times. Every new filming session on a movie set somewhere would have increased the chances of being caught. Perhaps if moon hoax believers were familiar with all of the Apollo missions and understood something about their critical preliminary Mercury and Gemini work of figuring out how to launch, orbit, spacewalk, rendezvous, and live in space, they would see this in a new light. No one just announced to the world out of the blue that men were on the moon. Thousands of people put in years of very hard work to make it happen. This was one of humankind's finest moments, one everyone should share in. Nostradamus. Excluding purely religious figures, Michel de Nostradam, or Nostradamus, is easily the most popular supernatural, paranormal predictor of future events in all of human history. This guy died in 1556, and yet today he continues to pop up in new books, websites, and TV shows. The History Channel seems committed to making sure the Nostradamus legacy lives on with its onslaught of questionable documentaries that link his writings to everything from the war in Afghanistan to Area 51. The funny thing is, however, Nostradamus doesn't deserve any of this attention. His predictions, if we can even call them that, collapse under the cruel and unforgiving weight of about 5 minutes of thoughtful analysis. Nostradamus was a 16th century French doctor and astrologer. That mix of trades was not as crazy then as it might seem today. People in the 1500s were deeply ignorant about medicine and astronomy, so it made perfect sense to have your doctor explain how your birth date determined the fate of your career and love life while he bled you dry in order to cure your sore throat. Understandably, one might think there must be something special about Nostradamus. After all, there were many fortune tellers, astrologers, and soothsayers banging about in Europe back in his day, but it's his name that we all know. Even now, there are plenty of people who make magical predictions all the time. Some of them have many followers and earn lots of money. Their track records seem no better or worse than Nostradamus. Yet he towers over them. Why? Nostradamus is known today for only two reasons: good marketing and bad thinking. The reason his name survives and thrives is because few people take the time to think critically about what he is supposed to have written and whether or not any of it can reasonably be considered accurate predictions of important future events. The weak skepticism that is endemic in the public has allowed his myth to grow against all odds. His fame comes from the snowballing momentum of a concoction long known to capture minds and win hearts. It's often described as smoke and mirrors, or if you prefer, just plain bull. The Nostradamus phenomenon is a good example of the illusion of truth effect. Hearing something over and over makes it believable to many people, no matter how silly it may be. No doubt conformity or the bandwagon effect comes into play here for many people as well. If you happen to have a circle of friends who constantly rave about the remarkable powers Nostradamus had, then your fallible human brain might be lured in. A crucial piece of the Nostradamus puzzle is the manner in which he went about communicating his predictions. He wrote them as quatrains, four-verse poems. If you ever want to make it as a prophet, make sure to be as poetically ambiguous and confusing with your words as you can. The more flowery and hazy your language is, the more likely your predictions will be hailed as correct by sloppy thinkers one day. For example, Nostradamus did not write, "A viral plague will sweep across the world in 1918 and kill more than 20 million people." He did not write, "On July 20th, 1969, three men will journey to the moon and two, named Armstrong and Aldrin, will walk upon its surface." Predictions like that are far too clear and easy to give a pass or fail grade to. We can't even be sure that Nostradamus wrote the things his fans say he wrote, because none of his original works have survived. The quotes you may have read or heard about on TV are translations of questionable copies of second-hand copies and so on. Who knows? Maybe he really did predict the future with total accuracy, but we'll never know because we can't assess his original work. What we do know is that the predictions that have been popularized are not impressive by any reasonable standard. Listen to these lines attributed to Nostradamus and judge for yourself. "Beasts wild with hunger will cross the rivers. Most of the fighting shall be close by the Hister. It shall end in the Great One being dragged in an iron cage, while a German shall be watching the infant Rhine." Well, that couldn't be any more clear. Obviously, it is referring to Adolf Hitler, which is precisely what countless Nostradamus experts have declared. Hister is very close to Hitler, right? No denying that. Here we have a reference to someone who would not even be born until centuries after Nostradamus' death, and yet Nostradamus knew of him. But hold on, Hister may sound a lot like Hitler, but it sounds even more like Hister, which is what the Danube River in Germany was called during Nostradamus' day. Another clue that this might be about a river and have nothing to do with the 20th century dictator is the fact that the line preceding it says something about crossing a river. Don't think I picked a bad example to make Nostradamus' belief seem silly. This is one of the most popular quatrains of all. No doubt some Nostradamus believers do not agree with the Hister-Hitler connection. Without exception, however, every believer I have had discussions with cited this one in attempt to convince me that Nostradamus had supernatural powers. There may not be much to the Nostradamus myth, but there is a valuable lesson here that can be applied broadly. If we don't want to be duped, we have to resist placing trust in strained interpretations and trying too hard to make a claim fit the facts. Good skeptics also give thought to context. just because someone may be on a fancy television show that has nice special effects and a pleasing music score doesn't mean that she necessarily knows what she is talking about or is telling the truth. Too many people hear a soundbite from a UFO, ghost, or Nostradamus expert and feel inclined to accept it as fact. Don't do that. Think less about who is making a big claim and more about what is being claimed. Even if a Nobel Prize-winning scientist were to announce tomorrow that after careful study, she had come to the conclusion that Nostradamus was a genuine prophet with supernatural abilities, it wouldn't be enough to convince me. She would get my attention based on her credentials, of course, but without very good evidence, her claim would mean nothing. Near-death experiences. One of the most popular beliefs of all time is the one that says we get to live on in a different form and in a different place after we die. If true, it means that death isn't really death in the sense that it marks the true end of it all. It's a transition, nothing more. This is an extraordinary claim, of course. Unfortunately, it doesn't have any extraordinary evidence to go with it. The best we have are unusual stories from a small number of people who claim to have died and then been whisked away to heaven or hell for a brief visit before returning to Earth to live again. Near-death experiences are viewed by many people as nothing less than absolute proof that there is an afterlife. I certainly agree that these accounts can be powerful and make a huge emotional impact on us. I met a woman who said she died and visited heaven before being sent back to Earth by Jesus himself. She told me all about the gates of heaven being fixed with pearls and diamonds, streets that were literally paved with gold, and fruit bowls that magically replenished themselves when emptied. She saw angels teaching newcomers how to properly worship God. And then she met Jesus. His beard was cut perfectly, she said, and he had the most beautiful crystal blue eyes. He spoke to me, saying he would anoint me and send me back to Earth. I also have read books by people who claim to have died and gone to heaven. I even read one by a man who says he died and went to hell for a brief time. When people cite stories like this in an attempt to convince me that there is an afterlife, however, I point out that although there may be an afterlife, we can't rely on stories to prove it. This is too big and too important to simply trust a tale told by a person who is no less fallible than the rest of us. I may be willing to assume that a particular storyteller is sane and honest, but how can I be sure that this person did not simply experience an extreme dream that left him with an emotionally charged memory that he then confused for a real experience? We know that this kind of thing can and does happen. The man who went to hell, for example, began his amazing journey from his bed after going to sleep at night. He woke up on the floor next to his bed. He was shaken up and scared, and says he clearly remembers being in hell, but did he really ever leave his bedroom? Aren't a dream and the imperfections of human memory the most likely explanations for what happened to him? Without evidence, I would never accuse any of these people of being dishonest, but I do accuse all of them of being human. And with that comes an inescapable vulnerability to wild dreams, delusions, hallucinations, and flawed or false memories. Brain science can provide likely natural explanations for the standard components of most near-death experience stories. A light at the end of tunnel, feelings of peace and tranquility, seeing loved ones and meeting religious figures can all be explained by natural processes in the stressed or dying brain. Nothing supernatural is necessary. This does not disprove the existence of some kind of an afterlife, of course, only that these near-death experience stories are not the overwhelming proof so many people think they are. If only some of these people could bring back a piece of heaven to show us and prove their claim. Maybe a magically replenishing fruit bowl, for example? If physical objects can't make the return trip, what about information? Something so special and unique that we all would know that somebody really did go to heaven or hell. But all we ever hear are dramatic stories that easily could have been produced by dreams and imagination. When the brain is short on oxygen, very weird things can happen. Pilots report having tunnel vision, light at the end of a tunnel, before blackout from extreme G-forces in a cockpit or during a centrifuge ride. This is because blood drains from the eyes first before blackout. People who are not dying but who have brains that are being stressed and oxygen-deprived also report seeing people and things that are not there. Scientists can even induce hallucinations and out-of-body experiences in a person who is not oxygen-deprived or dying by simply targeting a specific area of the brain with a mild electrical current. That's it. No afterlife needed, just electricity. I can personally connect with stories that describe feelings of pure peace and calm even as death approaches. When I was around 12 years old or so, I banged my face and cut my leg during a bad fall while crossing a canal on an elevated sewer pipe. Battered and bleeding, lying on the canal's bank, I was in bad shape. But I felt great. My brain took me someplace far away from agony and panic. I remember lying there, face in the dirt, feeling nothing but groovy. It wasn't bad enough to qualify as a near-death experience, and I don't remember feeling like I ever left my physical body, but it was definitely an unusual experience. The nice feelings soon faded, of course, and pain arrived. Because of that incident, I have no problem understanding what people are talking about when they say they felt happy and wonderful, even though they were dying. I also can believe people when they say they had unusual visions or felt like they went somewhere in this state. But why would anything like this be proof of something so extraordinary as heaven, hell, or some other kind of afterlife? Maybe it would help if we all keep in mind what the human brain is capable of conjuring up when things are going well. On a nice day when the sun is shining and our health is optimal, we are all capable of being fooled by our brains to see, hear, feel, experience, and remember things that are not real and never happened. If this is possible, and we know it is, then shouldn't we be skeptical about claims of experiences that occur to people who are near death or thought to be dead briefly? Don't you think a human brain under that kind of stress would be even less reliable? If one wants to hope for something more after death, that's fine, of course. Like most people, I certainly would love to cheat death somehow. But no one should be misled to think that there is some vast collection of near-death cases that have proved the existence of an afterlife. All we have are stories, which alone prove nothing. Bermuda Triangle. There is a mysterious zone over a patch of sea that functions as some kind of a natural or supernatural black hole, sucking up ships and planes that are never to be heard from again. Is it a portal to another universe? Could there be extraterrestrial involvement? Is the lost city of Atlantis involved? All we know for sure is that something very strange and very dangerous is happening in the area known as the Bermuda Triangle. Wow, what an exciting claim. I have lived much of my life very close to the Bermuda Triangle. I have even gone swimming in it. How exciting. Too bad it's nonsense. One way to better understand and evaluate a weird claim such as the Bermuda Triangle is to look at its history. Where does it come from? Who was the first person to make the claim? What was the original context? How was the case for it first made? Finding the answers to such basic questions often sheds enough light on the belief to expose it as unworthy of your time. As we will see shortly, there are the usual problems with evidence and the interpretation that slay the triangle myth. But first, its origin makes it clear that this claim was hopelessly lost at sea from the start. The earliest known mention of the Bermuda Triangle was an article in Argosy, February 1964. This was a pulp fiction magazine that published fictional stories designed to excite and entertain young males. That's right. It wasn't the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Coast Guard, or National Geographic that broke the story and first alerted the world to the dangers of the Bermuda Triangle. No, it was a magazine that specialized in adventure fiction. The article's author, Vincent Gaddis, was probably looking for nothing more than another freelance check and never imagined he would help to create one of the great myths of modern times. But he did. A writer named Charles Berlitz outdid Gaddis and really cashed in on the triangle with his nonfiction bestseller, The Bermuda Triangle, in 1974. Against all reason, it was such a hit that it anchored the Bermuda Triangle in pop culture by convincing millions around the world that the threat was real and deadly. Sadly, it didn't matter that he failed to present a convincing case based on facts and logic. Berlitz's evidence consists of nothing more than a collection of outrageous, unproven claims and heavily embellished sea tales. Berlitz also wrote other books, such as Atlantis, the Eighth Continent, and the Roswell Incident, whose evidence is of similarly questionable accuracy. For a comprehensive takedown of this belief, read Larry Kusche's excellent book, The Bermuda Triangle Mystery Solved. Kusche dismantles claim after claim and shows how a minor story or a made-up story can be twisted and embellished to seem like compelling evidence of something sinister and supernatural. For example, the tragic incident of Flight 19 is probably the most famous of all triangle stories. According to Berlitz and other triangle proponents, however, the five U.S. Navy Avenger torpedo planes took off from Fort Lauderdale Air Base on December 19, 1945, and in ideal flying conditions, vanished without a trace in a way that defies any natural explanation. Kusche shows that an honest look at the facts reveals a different story, however. Flight 19's commander was new to the base and unfamiliar with South Florida. They probably got his group lost, and they ran out of fuel before they could find land. Then they ditched at sea in the dark and in rough sea conditions. It should surprise no one that no wreckage was ever found. Heavy things like airplanes tend to sink in the ocean. Suddenly it doesn't seem quite so paranormal, right? This leads us to the greatest of all problems with the Bermuda Triangle claim. When planes and ships travel over water, bad things sometimes happen. We should expect this. Due to the nature of accidents at sea away from land, there are not always clear and obvious explanations available. But a mystery or unanswered questions is not proof of a supernatural or paranormal event. This is the problem with the Bermuda Triangle. People have attempted to explain many different incidents with one overall theory. But there is not one cause, supernatural or natural, for thousands of mishaps over many decades in this one area or any other. My research, which began as an attempt to find as much information as possible about the Bermuda Triangle, had an unexpected result, writes Kusha. After examining all the evidence, I have reached the following conclusion. There is no theory that solves the mystery. It is no more logical to try to find a common cause for all the disappearances in the triangle than, for example, to try to find one cause for all automobile accidents in Arizona. By abandoning the search for an overall theory and investigating each incident independently, the mystery began to unravel. I'm confident that ships and planes do not vanish in the Bermuda Triangle at a rate or in a manner that indicates there is anything unusual going on there. But I like to be thorough, so I checked with both the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Coast Guard just to be safe. Neither organization seems worried about this. The U.S. Navy has more reasons than anyone to be concerned about threats to ships and planes. After all, it routinely sends thousands of sailors and aviators into the zone, along with billions of dollars worth of ships, submarines, and aircraft. Yet the Navy has gone on record rejecting any consideration of the Bermuda Triangle as an unusual threat to them. Finally, if anyone should know if there is anything to the Bermuda Triangle claim, possibly even more so than the U.S. Navy, it would be the people who are specifically responsible for safety and rescue in and around the Triangle area. So I phoned the Miami station of the United States Coast Guard and spoke to an officer there who told me that they do not believe in the Bermuda Triangle story, nor do they give it any consideration when going about their duties. He also referred to this official statement by the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard does not recognize the existence of the so-called Bermuda Triangle as a geographic area of specific hazard to ships or planes. In a review of many aircraft and vessel losses in the area over the years, there has been nothing discovered that would indicate that casualties were the result of anything other than physical causes. No extraordinary factors have ever been identified. Case closed. Mystery solved. Let's have a long overdue burial at sea for this one. The Bermuda Triangle needs to go back to being what it originally was, just a good story meant to entertain and not to be taken seriously by serious people. It's a great campfire tale to tell the kids while vacationing in South Florida or the Caribbean, but nothing more. Sadly, however, after appearing to fade in the 1990s, the Bermuda Triangle is enjoying a bit of a renaissance today. No doubt this is due to the abundance of misleading websites that promote its existence as historical truth and scientific fact. There has also been an avalanche of terribly misleading pseudo-documentaries about it on cable TV. These have modernized and popularized the myth for a whole new generation of uncritical thinkers. Atlantis. Atlantis, the extraordinary ancient city continent that was struck by disaster and sank into the sea, is an example of an unproven belief that may be more fun than threatening. So what if some people believe in a mythical place that was more technologically advanced than we are today and spawned all the great ancient civilizations? What's the harm? The problem is that Atlantis belief is a symptom of something more serious. Falling for this claim can be viewed as a wailing alarm that indicates something is wrong with a person's thinking process. If Atlantis belief makes it into one's head, then it means that one's skepticism force field is either switched off or turned down way too low. After all, if one is capable of believing this claim, despite all of its logical problems and a total absence of proof, then it's likely not going to take much of a leap for this person to believe in a potentially dangerous medical product, invest in scams, or be exploited in a variety of ways by unscrupulous people and organizations. Alone, such beliefs may initially appear to be harmless, but seemingly benign claims may lead people deeper into a variety of weird beliefs and delusions that do cause harm. For example, Atlantis belief has an odd connection to unproven New Age claims about crystals having healing powers. How easy would it be for some people encouraged by their Atlantis belief to begin wasting time and money on crystals? This could easily lead to serious problems if people choose crystals over medical science. A harmless belief in Atlantis could become a very dangerous belief in the medical value of overpriced rocks. By the way, some listeners may suspect that Atlantis is a fringe belief in the extreme, one not worth addressing because it involves so few people. According to surveys, however, this is not so. A 2006 Baylor study, for example, found that more than 40% of American adults believe in ancient advanced civilizations, such as Atlantis. More alarming than that, however, is another study that found 16% of high school science teachers believe in Atlantis. As is so often the case when evidence is not involved, the description of a belief varies wildly and depends on which believer one asks. Some Atlantis believers say it was a prominent city, continent, that existed several thousand years ago and was advanced far beyond its ancient peers, and some say even beyond 21st century civilization. For example, some claim that the Atlanteans had nuclear weapons, aircraft, and energy production technology that was far superior to ours today. Some believers go so far as to claim that extraterrestrials are involved with Atlantis either as visitors or were the Atlanteans themselves. Virtually all believers agree that the city, continent, vanished due to a catastrophic event such as an earthquake or a tsunami. Today it is supposed to rest on the floor of the Mediterranean Sea at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, or maybe under Antarctic ice somewhere, awaiting discovery. Another popular component to the myth is that before its violent end, Atlantis spawned satellite cultures that were the seeds of modern civilization. One version says we are the descendants of inferior slaves who escaped just before disaster struck the city. Either way, all people today are deeply connected to Atlantis. Okay, I admit it, this is another great story. I get why people might feel an urge to believe it, but if you think first, it's not quite so impressive. Before we consider some of the reasons why doubt as an order, let's be clear about something important. Atlantis has not been discovered, and no compelling archaeological or historical evidence for it has ever been produced by anyone. This needs to be stated because many people seem to think it has been found, or at the very least there is enough evidence to confirm that it did exist. Many people have likely been misled about the status of Atlantis because its discovery or near discovery is reported frequently by the mainstream news media. Consider these recent headlines. Tsunami clue to Atlantis found. Satellite images show Atlantis. Atlantis obviously near Gibraltar. I chose these headlines specifically because they all come from the BBC, one of the world's most respected and trustworthy news organizations. In fairness, the BBC did place quote marks around keywords within two of these headlines. This is to shift the burden of the claim off of the BBC and onto some person who made the claim. Also, in many cases, reports like this usually do reveal somewhere in the text of the article that nothing of consequence has been found and absolutely nothing about Atlantis has been confirmed. These kinds of reports have always turned out to be nothing more than an exciting lead, a possible clue, or encouraging data, anything but actual artifacts that confirm the existence of Atlantis. The damage is done, however, because many people see headlines like these and don't bother to read the entire article, or if they do, can still be deeply influenced by the eye-catching headline. If they don't quite turn into confident Atlantis believers, they still might come away with the false impression that there must be something to this claim. But as we are about to see, there is nothing here but a tall tale. The only references to Atlantis in ancient times come from an impressive source, Plato, one of history's great philosophers. He mentions the city in two of his dialogues, the Timaeus and the Critias. But what did he actually communicate about Atlantis? It seems that for the purposes of teaching a lesson, Plato referred to an old story about a city-state that was too militaristic and too arrogant for its own good. This suggests that he wasn't presenting a serious historical report on a real place and real people. He was almost certainly using a fictional tale to help make a point to the people he was addressing. There is nothing about Plato's mention of Atlantis that makes the case for its existence. This view is supported by the fact that there is total silence about Atlantis from the rest of the ancient world. Atlantis was supposed to have been vastly superior in technology, science, and culture, and to have given rise to all other great civilizations. Yet there is no mention of it from the Egyptians, Carthaginians, Romans, Sumerians, Babylonians, Ionians, Macedonians, and so on. Archaeologist Kenneth L. Fader hammers this point home in his excellent book, Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries, Science and Pseudoscience in Archaeology. You will not read the discourses of modern historians arguing for or disputing the historicity of The Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, because these are understood, of course, to be works of fiction. In much the same way, Greek historians who followed Plato did not feel the need even to discuss his story of Atlantis. They understood it as the work of fiction Plato intended it to be. An important thing to keep in mind is that believers often try to lure skeptics into arguing against things they don't even oppose. For example, I've had discussions with Atlantis believers who, after becoming frustrated by their failure to convince me, changed course and accused me of being closed-minded, anti-science, and unwilling to consider the possibility that underwater archaeologists might find an ancient city one day, maybe even one that was called Atlantis. Of course they might. I am a big fan of underwater archaeology. I have interviewed Bob Ballard, discoverer of the Titanic and the Galapagos Rift hydrothermal vents, and I share his enthusiasm and optimism for underwater archaeology's potential. We have been a coastal-dwelling and seafaring people for a long, long time. Lakes, seas, and oceans undoubtedly hide many amazing artifacts that can shed new light on our past. Furthermore, given the volatile nature of our world and its changing shorelines, the claim that an ancient city is lying in ruins underwater somewhere is not only reasonable, it's very likely to be true. Who knows? Maybe there is even a city that was named Atlantis out there. But until somebody finds it, we don't know. And if the ruins of such a city are found, that still would not prove that it had once been inhabited by an advanced race of people or some alien species. To stay true to the real world, we have to ask the right questions, hold out for evidence, and not allow ourselves to be sidetracked by claims we're not refuting. In other words, we need to try to become and remain good skeptics. Area 51. Imagine you are the President of the United States, or a top Air Force general. A frantic aide has just burst through your office door. My God, it's been confirmed. Our team on the ground has secured the crash site and report that it is definitely an extraterrestrial vehicle of some kind, and the deceased bodies of 4 alien occupants have been recovered. What are your orders? You would have the wreckage and the bodies sent to Area 51, of course. Where else? Everyone knows that's where the government stashes all visitors from outer space. Area 51 shows up in so many science fiction books and films, and has been a flashpoint for UFO believers for so many years now, that it has evolved into something of a comical cliché in pop culture. I won't be surprised if I turn on my TV one day soon and hear something like this. Lee Harvey Oswald, an alien hybrid Libra with psychic powers, teleported to a hangar inside Area 51, where his brain was reverse-engineered by former Nazi scientists who themselves had been chemically lobotomized by the Men in Black, who are actually rogue CIA agents in close communication with fluoride-free extraterrestrials. How did Area 51 become ground zero for weird American myth? What is Area 51, and what really goes on there? First of all, Area 51 does exist, and mysterious things do happen there. No one can deny that. After many years of secrecy and denial, it is now a matter of public record that very unusual things have been going on at this top-secret government base for decades. But aliens on ice? Flying saucers? Reverse-engineered extraterrestrial technology? Probably not. Believers in Area 51 mythology get tripped up when they confuse plain secret aviation activity for secret aviation activity involving aliens. They also mistake secret military aircraft with extraterrestrial spaceships. For such a big secret, an awful lot is known about Area 51. We know, for example, that it is part of a larger U.S. military base located in the Nevada desert, less than 90 miles from Las Vegas. The general area is also called Paradise Ranch and Groom Lake. The U.S. military develops and flies new aircraft there. Many of these flights are conducted at night to enhance secrecy. The CIA also uses the base for the same purpose. One would have thought that UFO sightings around a region like this would be expected by everyone, not met with suspicion and runaway imagination. The list of aircraft now publicly known to have flown at Area 51 includes some revolutionary planes, amazing flying machines like the U-2, A-12, and the now-famous SR-71 Blackbird flew there in extreme secrecy from the 1950s through the 1990s. These sleek reconnaissance planes were extraordinary both in appearance and for what they could do. They were capable of flying at speeds faster than 2,000 miles per hour and reaching altitudes above 85,000 feet. By comparison, the cruising altitude for a typical modern commercial jet is 35,000 feet, and they usually fly at speeds of less than 600 miles an hour. The SR-71's Cold War mission was to fly far, high, and fast in order to take photos of Soviet bases and activities on the ground. Even today, it's difficult not to be impressed by the sleek and futuristic lines of the SR-71. There is one on an elevated display at the San Diego Air and Space Museum that allows visitors to walk under it. The underbelly view makes it very easy to imagine how a layperson 50 years ago might have felt certain that she had seen something from another world if one of these roared overhead shortly after takeoff or was spotted out of a window high above a normal plane in flight. The B-2 Spirit bomber and the F-117 Nighthawk also flew at Area 51 before anyone outside of select military and government channels knew anything about them. The B-2, with its sweeping batwing and tailless design, looks like something a Hollywood special effects company might have come up with. Seen in flight, from some perspectives, it does not appear to be a conventional plane at all. It can look, surprise, very much like the stereotypical flying saucer. The F-117 Nighthawk is another bizarre warplane. It has a boxy design with unusual angles and an unexpected rudder-elevator fusion configuration in the rear. We've come a long way from the Wright brothers. How far is anyone's guess, however, because the strange aircraft that we know flew at Area 51 can only tease us and hint at what we don't know and what might be flying in secrecy there or at some other base right now. Some people cite what they say is a high number of UFO sighting claims around Area 51 as proof or evidence that the government has alien spacecraft there and is operating them or has reverse-engineered alien wreckage and built its own. The first problem with this is that seeing unknown aircraft near a secret base that flies